The title of tonight's talk and our discussion is Causes and Conditions. And that title changed from Who Am I? Where did my old life come from? And where is it going? When I left my house tonight. The second part, Who Am I? Those questions come from Shin Buddhism. And I think they're beautiful questions. Someone handed me a little piece of paper in a workshop I was leading one day and said that these are questions that are given to a woman who is about to marry in that culture and the custom when she's going to leave the home and go to the home of her husband. Who am I? Good one to drop in every once in a while we're sitting. Where did my life come from? My old life come from? And where is it going? So today I was sitting in my backyard planning to talk about something completely different until about 3 o'clock, and I thought, well, I have to talk about my friend John, because that's what's been in my heart for the last week or so. About a week and a half ago, I was reading the paper one morning and looking at the obituaries, as I have a habit of doing, and I noticed that I tend to look at the obituaries that have pictures, and I tend to gravitate more towards people who are young pictures. And sometimes you're fooled because the photos are of somebody who's old, who's died, but they're using a young photo, because that's when people most remembered them. That's when perhaps they were in the world the most. We actually did that when my mother died, and I didn't like the idea, but it's how my mother would have wanted to be known. So I saw this face of someone I thought I recognized from 11 years ago. The last time I saw him was just over 11 years ago. And so I'm looking at it, he's older, and then the name, John O'Neill. It's like, yeah. And the first line was, died tragically while saving his dog. And it's like, okay. It's like, how old is John? John was like 40-something. And so I called Eric, my husband, and told him. It's like, John was a sailor. He was my one of my best friend's boyfriends. The last time I saw him was on the day Dottie died, when we took the breathing tube out of her together and sat with her, telling her how much we loved her when she died. And thought he must have drowned. He must have jumped off the boat when the dog jumped off. Stories. No clue, but made up a story of how somebody could die tragically while saving their dog. So a few days, and so we talked. Should we go to the funeral? We haven't seen him for so long. And both of us had an inclination. And then the next day or two, there was an article about it in the paper with another photo and a picture of him with a dog. And the article talked about how he died. He loved dogs, and he had a dog that ran out into the middle of the street a year ago and was killed by the Anjuda streetcar who lived on Judah Street. And his brother said that he was, I forget the word that he used, distraught. Didn't talk about it. I don't know about other Irish folks, but sometimes there can be a tendency to keep it inside. And he said he couldn't talk about the dog, and he was really, really upset. And he got another dog about a few months ago and was walking the dog, and the dog got loose and ran out into the middle of the street and to the trolley car track at the Anjuda. And he ran after that dog to get him. And he picked him up and turned around, and there it was right here. And he threw the dog away, and the dog survived, and he died. And he was 47 years old. So I've been thinking about him, and we did go to the funeral. And it's made me really think about causes and conditions of what happens and how. And I was walking with a friend, Barbara Gates, who's the editor of Inquiring Mind, and telling her this story. And she said, you know, if you wrote it, you'd almost have to change the ending. People wouldn't believe it, you know, hit by the same streetcar. So we decided to go to the funeral because of two reasons. We wanted to represent Dottie because we weren't sure who, we hadn't seen John for a long time. We wanted to be there and represent Dottie. And we really wanted to honor this selfless act. Really reminded me of the Jataka tales of the Buddha, the one where the Buddha, they were hungry. Were they wolves? Hungry?
Tigers.
Tigers. Yeah, hungry tigers that the Buddha threw himself as food, well, the Bodhisattva, threw himself to them to be consumed, to be eaten, as an act of kindness. So I really have been thinking about that in the story of John. So we went, and it was an open casket, and I haven't been to a funeral with an open casket in a while. And I don't know, only thing I can say is it's pretty weird. We have some bizarre customs, and I only mean bizarre in that I think it's wonderful for closure for people. I really do. But it's a little, I mean, I watched all of 6 Feet Under. I don't know if anybody else did, but I watched every episode. So, you know, makeup and reconstruction, and, you know, it's like, it's a little, it was hard to see this body that had no life in it. You know, it's like had nothing to do with who am I? Who are you? Who was he? So who he was is the other reason we went to the memorial. And my friend Dottie had cystic fibrosis. I've talked about her here before. And she was just the most fun person I've ever known in my life. So full of joy. She was just fun. She was really alive. Maybe because she always knew she was going to die. She had cystic fibrosis. She was 42 when she died, which was old for someone to die when they have cystic fibrosis. And she was a nurse. She was a heart transplant coordinator for UCSF. She's the kind of person that would come up here and talk about anything, I guess her subject, and get like all, I don't, you know what, an aside, I also watched The Critics, and they stopped doing the thumbs up last time. It was such a shock. That was definitely an aside. But anyway, so Dottie broke up with John. In the last year, she had a horrible last year of life. She had the heart-lung transplant. It was a success, but the body didn't reject the organs. The organs had something called cytomegalovirus, which half of us have, and it's okay. But when you transplant that much heart and lungs in a 5 feet tall body, it overwhelmed the system, and she... The new lungs fibrosed. So she started distancing herself from John. And I honestly don't know why. You know, why do people do stuff? I'm not quite sure why she really loved him. In fact, I was with her one day at Spirit Rock when she told the whole group. She asked Sylvia Borstein if she thought that somebody got Dottie's heart. Dottie only needed lungs, but it was easier surgically to transplant both if someone got her heart. And she asked Sylvia if she thought that the person who had her heart felt her heart broken because she'd broken up with John. It was very moving. So moving. And when she went into the hospital, off and on that year, when she went in for the last time, she was really pretty emaciated and tiny. And she called John. She asked him to pretend that it was a year before. And he did. He pretended and came to the hospital every day. Every night he was there. And no one would ever have thought they had ever separated. And in fact, the causes and conditions conditioned the love to really be there. You know, they loved each other a lot. So we went to honor John. Mm-hmm. And his bodhisattva acts, really. Bodhisattva acts, placing others in front of him. So I was thinking, what was the act? You know, what was that act of going out in the middle of the streetcar? I've really been thinking about it. Was it an act of love? Was it an act of fear? Was it an act of courage, of bravery? Was it all of those things? You know, his brother said he just couldn't stand the fact that this other dog had died. So because of causes and conditions, he ran out there. He ran out there. Whatever that intention was, I don't think he could have done anything other than save that dog. You know, it's just that impulse. I've read stories before about people in emergency situations find enormous physical strength, also courage, the physical strength. I read a report of somebody when a child was trapped underneath a car once, this fellow lifted a car up. He had a bad heart, and it weighed, you know, what do cars weigh? Tons? A ton. And saved the little girl, and afterwards, there's no way he could have lifted that. But something happens in those moments of selflessness. It was like, get out of the way. Not in the way, an act of selflessness. So at the funeral, there were pictures of John's life, and there were pictures of John and Dottie. And John's girlfriend relationship was there. And they talked about, John's brother talked about her having just what John needed in a partnership. Patience, patience, patience. Could not ever quite make the total commitment. And seeing pictures with Dottie and John on the picture board were really moving. So Eric, my husband, said, should we walk by the casket? Because that's where the family stood on the right side of the church, and the coffin was, casket was in the middle. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, we don't know them. And I said, well, it's okay. We'll go and say something. And it was so moving to talk to them and say, you know, that we were here because of Dottie and what a good guy John was. And it just, her sister just hugged and hugged me and cried. She said, oh, he's with Dottie now. He's with Dottie now. And then in one of the eulogies that were spoken by the family, one of the family members said that he was with his father, and he was with Dottie, and he was with Idaho Jack, the dog that died. And, you know, it's not at all my... belief system, I don't know what the word would be, but who cares? I mean, really, who knows, truly, what happens? And I was just so happy that they included Dottie, even with his current girlfriend, and I hoped it didn't hurt her. I really hoped it didn't hurt her. So I'm looking at, who am I? Who was he? Who are we? What are we? When you look at that question, what comes up? Ask yourself, who am I? Anyone got a clue?
I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I just got married and I'm changing my name. And I bought a laptop the other day and it happened to be the same one that my husband has. And I was so angry about that because it felt like I wasn't individual anymore. And I feel like so much of how I'm defining myself is in relation to other people. I'm Scott's wife. I'm Jack's aunt. I'm not myself anymore as much. I've lost and gained a lot, but definitely lost part of my individual identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been thinking about this a lot.
Mm-hmm. Who were you before?
I was a lot before. I was creative. I cooked, I had a lot of friends, I went to meditation groups, which I don't do that much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I loved being outdoors and walking, and it gets to be less of a percentage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how much of my time is, okay, everything else is done, now who do I want to be?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad thing, it's just different.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the pie has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Or you just included somebody else in all of that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
A big part.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Big life change.
Oh, huge.
Mm-hmm.
And changing my name and people call me a different name, I'm like, who's that? That's weird.
Mm-hmm. Wait till you're Mrs. Simmons.
I know, I've gotten that also. I said, no way. Still Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
What else? Who else is here? Olive.
It's almost that I and everybody in my life. And one of the reasons I say that is that over the last few years, my adult children have been in crisis, and I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with them. And as an observer, and I see myself so clearly in them. And I don't mean all of me, but maybe a look, maybe a mannerism, maybe a phrase,
mm-hmm.
and in all three of them. And it's really kind of fascinating to see that, because the question then comes up is, again, who am I? Am I my mother?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, all the way back. But it really kind of is what I said. It's like, you know, I am everybody in my life now. Because I'm recognizing myself just in everybody.
Mm. Thank you. Who else?
Seem to be the composite of my thoughts,
mm-hmm.
whatever, you know, happens to be going on in my life at the moment is generating relations at work, things are going on in my apartment, there's I take on, and it just generates stories. And that seems to condition very much about who I feel I am right now. And I'm actually just starting a week's vacation, and I suspect by the end of the week, as I extract myself from the sort of the current stories and go somewhere else, that I'll probably have a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's so much is generated by who I feel I am at the moment. It's generated so much of that mental stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be fleshed out more. Things I do and blah, 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 but sort of my experience, the daily experience, is so much just about what's going on.
And you know, as the question of what thought am I believing right now, that actually James Barrows likes to ask people, what thought am I believing right now? Who am I believing I am right now?
Mm-hmm.
Goes along the lines of what you said, I think. Thank you.
I didn't come up with any answer if I ask myself who I am. I don't know. I like the sort of Tibetan Buddhist interpretation, you know, personality or personhood is this sort of heap of characteristics that's kind of flexible around the edges and changes according to circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like there's anything that solid there that I identify with. It's more a sort of a collection of maybe tendencies and beliefs.
Mm-hmm. There's that word belief again.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think to add to everything else, I mean, I suspect we're going to end up saying, yes, we're this, but that doesn't make the whole thing. But anyway, one of the many things that isn't the whole thing, I think, is our history.
Mm.
I think, I don't know, I wouldn't say I am my history, but I think my history determines a great deal of who I am. Some of it, some of it welcome and some of it not.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, where I was born, when I was born, and where I went, where I spent time, I wouldn't be the same person if I hadn't done those things. And yet again, maybe I would be, in some sense, still recognizable. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Our history, our story, our thoughts, our relationships, and all, changing all the time. You know, I actually, you know, who are we at the moment of death is a big question in this tradition. And every moment we're at the moment of death. Every moment, because every moment's coming and going, just like that, a wash of story, of relationship. Who are we at the moment of death? It's such a big question, and you've mentioned the Tibetan lineage. It's such a big question. It's the big question. And the moment of death is all the time. We favor one over others, but they're all coming and going in a wash of that river you were in last week or the week before, just a wash of things, of emotions, of story, of life. I was very struck by looking at this body that was really almost not a body anymore, almost a statue, and how, this person and I had a relationship 11 and a half years ago. We spent time together with someone we both loved a lot, and then to go there and see hundreds of people who knew this person in a different way. It's like, oh, not a husband, you know, but as a wife, as a creative person for you, you know, this shifting of identities, often in relationship to something else. My thoughts, my emotions, my story, my children, my husband. And right there, you know, in the center of this swirl is the truth. Right there in the center of this swirl is the truth. I think we can grab onto, it's like the Ferris wheel, grabbing that ring, you know, grabbing that ring. Okay, now I'm. Where did my old life come from? Genetics? Our life histories? Interesting. I was writing today and about a time of my life that was hard, and I was realizing that the nature of my family, my history, where I came from, is this real family of women. My mother was one of six daughters. And the habit that was created from the causes and conditions of generations was that these women were very exuberant, a lot of exuberance in the world, really a lot of lightness and fun, and everything's okay all the time. Everything's okay. In fact, I just spoke with my aunt who had a second stroke, and while I was talking to her, she said, yep, I'm doing fine, doing what they say, I'm just doing it, and I'm doing, you know. And I remembered what my mother used to say. She used to say, I'm just a plugger. There's a cartoon called The Pluggers. They just keep plugging away, just keep plugging away. And that's part of where I come from. You know, just keep plugging away. Yet, wherever we came from isn't what we have to get stuck with. Right there in the center, there's choice and freedom. Right there in the center, all the causes and conditions come to the moment. Sometimes it feels like we don't have choice, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But we do, or do we? We have karma. The results of causes and conditions, habits of mind, skillful habits, habits of open-heartedness, stinginess. The word dana is such a beautiful understanding, and it can hold both generosity and stinginess right in the center, you know, because it holds our relationship with giving, with money, loaded subject money. Do you know it's a more loaded subject than sex in the Dharma world? We were in a group together, Deb and I, and it's like the sex one was like a riot, you know, fun. And the money one, that was my hardest one. It's like from my history, because of the causes and conditions of my life that brought me to being a single mom on welfare, there's a lot of charge around money. And I have to watch it. You know, I really have to watch it. It's like when those construction guys are there for how many days and how many hours? It's like, right in the middle. So it comes all comes right down into intention. What did John do running out in that street? What were his intentions? His intentions had to be to save that dog. I mean, selfless act, automatic act, they're all preceded by intention, and oftentimes we're not even aware of them. I think last week I spoke with Richard for a minute or two tonight, and he taught last week, and he said he talked about aspiration a bit, and how intention or aspiration can get confused and all wrapped up in equanimity and just being with the way things are. If emotions are strong, people can have a misunderstanding that there's something wrong with them. Anger. It's an emotion. Motion. It comes and goes. Every time we, this is who I am now. I am angry. That's when we get pained. That's when we get locked up in suffering. Who am I? Motion, thought, history, all this coming and going with this incredible center of truth. This center right now in this moment. It's free. It's just those clingings get in the way. You know? Clingings to things not being like this. Oh, you know? Human beings. The clingings. So, in looking at John's life, I thought today about my 50th birthday party that was 7 years ago, and how my friend decided to get different family members and friends to do a skit of my life in front of people. It's like, oh, I have to tell you, I was like, and I knew it was going to happen. It's like, what are they going to say? How are they going to do this? What are they going to say? How embarrassed am I going to get? And they were pretty kind. They could have been, you know, they were pretty kind. But, I mean, I could pick up this identity of Bonnie as a kid, you know, who I was then, and Bonnie as a divorced single mother. That's a painful one to remember, painful time. Bonnie as an aerobics teacher. Can you see it? That was a fun one. That was great. That was a lot of fun. High impact aerobics. It's like, why do I sit with my knee up? It can go a half hour. High impact aerobics. And one of my friends, you know, came out in an outfit and did the whole thing. How will we remember? You know, we might want to have a certain legacy, but we've got no control over that. It's all about our actions. Nobody can see inside and see the intentions behind the actions. Some of the kindest acts some of the acts that look the kindest can really not be. Have you ever experienced that? With something you've done? Boy, it looks like. But you know, there's mixed in there. But it looks really good. So people know us by our actions, don't they? By our words, they don't know us by our thoughts unless the thoughts turn into speech. And those thoughts, as you said, here I am. But we learn. Looking at my family of the aunts again, they learned how to be because of causes and conditions of having a mother and a father who had mothers and fathers who had mothers and father, all the way down. Got to have both, whether they're in your life or not. There's that connection. And they had a father who had been in World War One. You know, he'd been in World War One before they were born. He came back, and this man was just a god to the girls. And my sister questioned whether he was shell-shocked by how they described him. And it's just, my sister's words were like, how could you say that? My sister's a questioner. She also questioned whether he actually was AWOL when he went back to Ireland during World War One. And boy, that was a huge one. That's the family, you're talking about the family history. Their father, who they had to be quiet around because loud noises made him jump. And he worked evenings, and he had six daughters. Causes and conditions. They had big personalities. I went to, when he wasn't working, he liked to golf. Every vacation was a golfing vacation in Florida, and they lived in Massachusetts. Every day off, every day at the end of his life, he golfed, I heard. When I was in Ireland last year, I picked up a book in a B&B called The Life and Times of Nuala O'Phelan. Anyone read that one? Wonderful. You read it? It's about a woman who was a human being who lived in Ireland and became a feminist and was really involved in writing and very, very smart, a lot of people, and a lot of drink and a lot of pain and a lot of stories about family and a father who sounded just like my grandfather, the hero, So we have our family myths. And we're all of this. I'm thinking of James Barris again because I just heard that he has an article coming out in O magazine in December. And it's very exciting, really happy. Because he leads joy groups, Awakening Joy. I mean, wonderful thing. And they've really spread around the globe. And he's writing about it for, and I've already pictured James sitting there with Oprah. I mean, can't you just see the face? You know, he's just going to see it. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. The causes and conditions that got James to want to spread joy. He's Jamie Appleseed of joy. He really is. He's Mr. Mudita. He is Mr. Mudita. He's a great guy. Makes me ask everyone, why did you come to this path? I know a bit about James. I know about me. And, it wasn't all fun and games that brought us to this path. And yet, James had a big opening early on, 30-some years ago, into the nature, the truth, and the center of things as being love and joy. And really has had an intention ever since then to, not ever since then, but kind of locked into a place of like thinking that Buddhism was all austere and suffering, only. Remember, the Buddha taught only suffering and the release from suffering. The release, and when the release is there, when we're not clinging, there's joy. Causes and conditions. Life unfolds. So I want to look at this center a little bit and read this poem from Dancing with Joy. Another one by my favorite, Mary Oliver, called Mindful. This is a practice of mindfulness. Coming into that center, right here, the truth of who we are. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, but leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extravagant, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. Mm-hmm. I heard her described as a national treasure. Tapping into that place of intention behind the actions helps to keep us on track. If we just paid attention, if we were just mindful of intention, everything becomes seen, clear. I heard this quote when I went on a retreat. I'm not sure who said it, but Steve Armstrong, a great teacher, said it in a Dharma talk. He was quoting someone. The winds of circumstance blow against emptiness. Who can they harm? When I left that retreat, this is a while ago, Jon Kabat-Zinn was the exit Dharma talker. And he likes to talk. It's a long talk. And it was a wonderful talk. And he said these words that I really love. When you go out into the world and live your life, you know, you're leaving a long retreat, really shaky times, he said, just let the Dharma do it. Mm-hmm. No problem. Just let the Dharma do it. So right there in that center of freedom, of impermanence, is love that is intelligent. Intelligence. It's bright and it's alive and it really knows. And if we start to listen to that inner wisdom, everything's okay. Everything's okay. If we just let the Dharma do it, just let the Dharma do it, it'll straighten itself out. And we're human beings. So tuning into this intelligence, into this knowing quality. And this isn't the kind of knowing where, you know you're going in the right direction. You're in the car, you're driving, you know you're going in the right direction, even though this is me. My sister is saying, this is the wrong direction. And having the causes and conditions before that led to irritability and my sister talking quite a bit, I was bound and determined that I knew that this was the right direction when I was going in. She was right. It's not the same kind of knowledge or inner knowing. It's a different kind. My family used to say, whenever my sister and I would say something positive about ourselves, they'd say, an empty barrel makes the most noise. Anyone ever heard that? An empty barrel makes the most noise. Don't toot your own horn. But boy, wow, if you look at it, an empty barrel makes the most noise. I think my friend Dottie was pretty empty in a lot of ways, and she really, really had a lot of effect and a lot of noise in the world, a lot of noise of joy, and it's really a loud song, that joy, joie de vivre. Yeats, A Dialogue of Self and Soul. Before we close, I am content to follow to its source every event in action or in thought. Measure the lot, forgive myself the lot. When such as I cast out remorse, so great a sweetness flows into the breast. We must laugh and we must sing. We are blessed by everything. Everything we look upon is blessed. And I love B-L-E-S-T. Everything I look upon is blessed. Even these hard places inside, these histories, these relationships, where are you going? Where is this life going? We've established who you are, who we are, where we came from, maybe. Where is this life going? What do you think? Where is this life going? Maybe we can't answer because we're not brides. Well, maybe.
I have no idea.
Anyone have any idea?
Well, it seems to me that I can see one way my life is going if I don't do something about it. Got an enormous inertia of, or momentum, or whatever you want to call it, and that's making it go in a direction that I don't much like. And it feels like it's going to take every bit of intention and effort and energy that I have to nudge it away into a different, slightly less bad direction. That's what it looks like to me a lot of the time, anyway. But the inertia is huge. I mean, I could just sit back and let it take its course, and, you know, next thing I know, I'd be dying and think, yep, that's what I thought would happen.
Yeah.
So that's one answer.
Thank you. And that inertia also keeps going when the direction gets changed. So inertia isn't just slows us down, it keeps us rolling. When the course changes, that's good news. That's really good news.
Yeah.
And the effort that you spoke of, the right effort, of non-striving and taking some time to just be where you are, so that you don't get exhausted. You know, does that make any sense?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Where else are you going?
Yeah. Aging. It's been really up for me lately. I work in nursing homes and
there's just been a rash of deaths, like just lots of people I've worked with for a long time died. And even though these people were old and ill, I still had, there's just this part in permanence that I just am blind to. And it just is sort of fascinating in a way, because I look at impermanence all the time. I look at the impermanence that comes up in mindfulness practice and the moment-to-moment changes that are going on. And still, when I go to work and XYZ patient has died, it's like, you know, what's up with that? I don't get it on some level. And then I look at my own body and see how there's starting to be some overlaps in the physical issues that the patients have and those that I have. And I look at my friends who I have, because of the causes and conditions of my life, I have a whole circle of friends that are 15 to 20 years older than I am. And so they're getting to be old or old, whatever. Somewhere on that spectrum is different than where I am. And, you know, seeing that we were just camping this weekend, and one of my friends that we were camping with is in that category, and she's now not able to do some stuff, but then it's coloring her perceptions, it's making her fearful in different ways. And so I'm questioning whether she has control over the mind states that go with that. I mean, I wasn't saying this to her, this was all just reflection on my part. But, you know, and then looking at intention, looking at people I know who have dementias, and how they move through that with greater or lesser degrees of grace, and is that, I mean, I would like to think that that's somewhat predicated on what the intentions have been through their lives and what the habits of mind have been, and, you know, that we have some control in that in some ways, because sometimes it certainly seems like that, and yet there are other stories where, you know, somebody will be the sweetest old demented person, you talk to their family, and it's like, oh, 5 years later they changed from the grump of the world into this sweet person, had nothing to do with their habits of mind. And so just all these questions are just really up for me. And looking at how, you know, it's difficult to age and to stay mindful and to maintain loving kindness for yourself in that process and for those around you in various stages of the process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Maybe that's the whole thing. Maybe it's the whole thing. How do you stay with a kind heart to whatever is happening, all these causes and conditions, whatever, you know, the relationships and the real challenge of that, you know, not to the joys and, you know, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And it's a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's a mixed bag. I think that's why we come. I think it's why each of us comes to this path, perhaps in one way or another, is to learn to have a little more, maybe we don't even know this, but to touch into what's really here, what's really here, but beneath all the comings and goings of things.
I read this great book a few years back called The Grace in Dying. You've probably read it.
I haven't.
It's a wonderful book. The premise is that as we die, that there's a natural process that allows us to let go and become okay with it to various degrees. And so, you know, in my more positive days, I look at the age of people that I work with, or my friends, or myself, and think, well, the good news is, I mean, you know, aging is difficult, but the good news is that, you know, we're going to end up having to let go of everything in one way or another, and that maybe the natural process and maybe a lot of our impetus in being in a path like this is to be able to do that in a more loving and graceful way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, I mean, if you know,
God were up there saying, we can do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. And the hard way is all that clinging onto our roles and our abilities and
the who I am.
The who I ams. And the easy way is letting it go as much as possible.
Doesn't it seem the opposite, though?
I know.
A lot of the time. Doesn't it seem the opposite?
I think what you had said about earlier about sort of seeing that we're dying all the time without doing it on the moment by moment way. Something from what I was saying earlier about a lot of thinking, finding, developing concentration helps sort of cut through that. Get to that more center that you're talking about. But just if we sort of see that we are aging every day, that death is going to be there. I think it's easier to not just wait until it happens. People have said to me, well, you could, color the gray in your beard and stuff. So, I don't really want to do that. There's a notion of denial in there that I really don't want to get wrapped up in. So I think start aging gracefully when you're 45 or 50.
How about when we're born?
Maybe even then is the way to start. If you're smart enough that you have smart people around you to teach you that, but not to sort of put it off too late when it gets hard. Yeah. Which isn't meaning we shouldn't try to keep what we have. It's not lying down. Start aging gracefully.
Thank you. So let's sit for a minute. In these bodies of whatever many years, just as we find them. Who am I? Where has my life come from? And where is it going? Remembering each other. This week, in our discussion, may we go our separate ways. May we find peace right in the center of it all. And may the world remember. Thank you.
Thank you.